On this episode of Video Culture, we'll talk Bond, James Bond, with Dr. No and the Living Daylights.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
Hi, Video Culture fans. This is Ryan and Matt.
Hey, guys.
We just have a little disclaimer for this podcast. We mentioned throughout this episode that the new Daniel Craig James Bond movie,
No Time to Die,
will be released at the time of this particular podcast, which would be sometime in April. But it was just announced that the release will be pushed back until after Thanksgiving 2020.
So there's a lot of inaccurate statements in this podcast about the new Bond movie. We done goofed up, I guess.
It still will star Daniel Craig as Bond. It's possibly his last Bond role.
It will come out unless the world dies. So here's hoping, fingers crossed, that we all get to see it.
Let's make sure we all don't get coronavirus.
Yeah, hopefully that joke ages really poorly by the time this comes out.
Yeah, so
hopefully that's all blown over.
Well, thanks very much, and we hope you enjoy this James Bond show.
And sorry about the goof up.
And on this week's episode, like I mentioned in the intro, we're talking Bond.
James Bond. Jinx.
Yeah, no. It's an easy line to remember.
Which was a James Bond character.
Yeah, right. And the very first time you see Sean Connery, that's basically what he says.
Yes.
That's his line. So from the first moment that we ever meet Bond, that's his name, and that's what everybody says. So before we talk about this, now we'll talk about why we chose Dr. No in Living Daylights in just a moment. But just to give our audience a background on Bond, mm-hmm. I'm gonna go through some facts first.
Sure.
Because this is not like any other movies that we've ever done before.
No. It's because we've done a movie and its sequel. This is something more than that.
Right. And this is something that's, there've been multiple. It's a whole franchise. It's one of the biggest movie franchises ever in history. And so James Bond essentially was created from a series of spy novel books from the late 50s and early 60s from writer Ian Fleming. Dr. No is the sixth book in the series, but the first to be made into a feature film. All Bond movies, except for two, were made by producers Salzman and Broccoli's production company, Eon Productions. That's E-O-N Productions. Eon was created for the sole purpose of producing Bond films in 1961 with financial backing from United Artists. And from what I understand, I think Salzman had the rights to the movies, and Broccoli wanted to do them and started inquiring about them. Mm-hmm. And instead of like them fighting over it, they decided that, you know, they would like team up together and they would need bigger budgets, and they would try to figure out how to get all this done. And so that's when they got like United Artists involved and MGM and all that kind of stuff. Harry Salzman's last Bond movie was in 1974 with The Man with the Golden Gun. And Salzman did a few more movies after that, but retired filmmaking in 1982 and died of a heart attack. I can't remember when he actually died. The only two non-Eon Bond films were Casino Royale in 1967, starred David Niven as Bond, and Never Say Never Again in 1983, starring once again Sean Connery as Bond. Although MGM bought the distribution rights to both films in the late 1990s, so yeah, everything is now like completely under like the MGM.
Yeah, and those like two umbrella. Films are kind of like the oddballs of the series. I mean,
yeah, but the weird thing is Sean Connery starred in Thunderball in 1965, and Never Say Never Again is also based on the novel Thunderball.
Also, it's weird. Super convoluted. Yeah.
Okay, so counting David Niven, there have been 7 actors to play James Bond. They've been Sean Connery, George Lazenby, Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton, Pierce Brosnan, and Daniel Craig. So George Lazenby played in the Casino Royale, right?
Now he was in Her Majesty's Secret Service, which was the third or second Bond.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, because he was like in between. No. He, like Sean Connery did a movie. And then, like, he did a movie, and then like, Sean Connery came back.
Yeah, because Sean Connery didn't want to come back, and right, they got Lazenby, and he's like, okay, I'll come back. And
he got like, and then Roger Moore was after that.
Yeah.
So counting David Niven on that from Casino Royale, there have been 7 actors to play, blah, blah, blah. So Sean Connery, George Lazenby, Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton, Pierce Brosnan. I already mentioned that.
You did.
I'll edit that out.
It's okay. Doobie-doobie-doo. Technical difficulties. Stand by.
All right. And there have been a total of 24 Bond films, and the 25th, No Time to Die, starring Daniel Craig and Rami Malek, was just released at the time of this podcast is published on April 10th, 2020.
Yeah, this should be hitting about 4 days after that. Yeah.
Yeah. So 4 days previous after this podcast officially released on April 14th, on April 10th. So by the time this podcast airs, there will be 25 Bond films. Yeah,
you guys don't know if it's good or bad. We don't know yet. You know, we hope it's good. You know, yeah. I hope every movie's good.
I don't know. And the funny thing is, we didn't even plan this to coincide with that at
all.
Weird
how that works, right?
It really didn't. I am being dead honest. It did not work out that way.
We don't plan that well, guys, if you haven't noticed.
We do not.
But no, anyway,
we're not good. Okay, so let me quickly go through the list of films. Dr. No, From Russia with Love, Goldfinger, Thunderball, You Only Live Twice, Honor Majesty's Secret Service, Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, The Man with the Golden Gun, The Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, A View to a Kill, The Living Daylights, License to Kill, Goldeneye, Tomorrow Never Dies, The World Is Not Enough, Die Another Day, Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, Skyfall, Spectre, No Time to Die. There's a lot of die in the.
It's sort of a theme.
Yeah. No Time to Die, Die Another Day.
So now that we got the kind of the premise out, and we got the admin work done about what this series is.
Yeah.
Let's talk about why we wanted to do this episode, because you were shocked to kind of find out that I don't really care for James Bond.
You're such a cinematic, you know, freak. You know, you like watch tons of movies.
From different genres, different styles, different countries.
And you are not into Bond films.
And I'm super open to most anything. But Bond, I'm like,
right.
Because I had seen a few of the Roger Moores. I'd seen 3 of the Timothy Daltons. I'd seen 3 of the Daniel Craigs. And I'm like, they're just not really for me.
Okay.
But I'd never seen a Sean Connery.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never seen a Timothy Dalton one. So we thought, well, that's kind of interesting. Yeah. Let's do that and see if.
Well, I think it was interesting for us to, number one, discover the origins of the Bond franchise. Yeah,
the beginning. I'd never seen the first one. You'd never seen the first one, really.
And then the other thing that we decided to pick up something interesting is when Roger Moore kind of retired from Bond, and there was a long period before another Bond movie was made, and then Timothy Dalton came in for 2 movies only and was not extremely well received, and it was a real departure from the Bond movies as far as like not only the character of Bond was slightly different, but also The type of movie that they made was more sort of realistic and more sort of like spy espionage versus, you know, like we have this madman or these group of people that are going to take over the world or destroy this one thing or like whatever. And, you know, it wasn't extremely well received by, you know, audiences, especially like British audiences.
And that was interesting to me.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I like the idea of taking the very, watching the very first and seeing how it began and then picking up a much maligned one and seeing, is it really that bad or is there something good about it? Because I actually like Timothy Dalton as an actor quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, surprisingly, I don't really like James Bond, but I like Dalton.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a for shame that it kind of ruined his career, you know.
For a while, definitely. Yeah. He's recovered since.
Yeah.
But that's kind of why we settled on this topic and these movies to see what we thought about them. And what I found interesting is there's a lot of similarities between these two films.
Right.
Both for good and bad.
Right.
There's interesting things about them. And I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to spoil a little bit.
Go ahead.
They didn't quite sway me. I still am a little indifferent to James Bond.
Okay.
But I found them interesting.
Okay.
Had you ever seen Dr. No? I don't think you had ever seen Dr. No.
I never seen Dr. No.
So let's start off with, what did you think of Dr. No?
I liked Dr. No as far as like a movie from the 60s. I felt like, I mean, we kind of talked about it in the it was a little dry. It was a little cutthroat, you know, like I felt like it was kind of a, it was like a whodunit, but like a spy film or like a private detective type of film, right? Like where you're trying to like figure out the story and you're seeing everything through the detective's eyes or whatever, right? So you're trying to like navigate through all of this. And then, but unlike where a detective doesn't really do a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So he just like by happenstance, like picks up where things are.
Yeah.
Sean Connery or like Bond always seem to be one step ahead of the game.
It's like Philip Marlowe was always playing catch up.
Yeah.
James Bond is always ahead of the game.
Right.
Like, you know, Philip Marlowe, he'd be sleeping in his bed. The bad guys would bust in, grab him and take him off in a car and threaten him. If the bad guys busted in on Bond, Bond would be sitting in his chair with his revolver or his pistol with a silencer on. We're just ready to shoot them and then say something quick, then say some sort of one liner about it, you know?
Right. Yeah. The only time that they ever got like one on Bond was like when they put the tarantula like in his bedroom or whatever.
But even then, he handles that really, really easily. And there's something to be said about and interesting about watching a character be hyper competent.
Right.
Watching a character be really good at what they do. And Sean Connery is very, very cool. And Dr.
Yes.
I mean, you can see why he became such a huge movie star.
Mm-hmm.
He is suave, he's dapper, but he's a little bit rugged at the same time.
Yeah.
And he's charming.
Oh, yeah. Extremely charming. I mean, I think I counted, he was with, he was with three chicks, and he was, like, flirting it up with Moneypenny.
Yes.
You know? So I was like, three women, not just one. There wasn't just like one Bond girl. I mean, there was the one Bond girl, like, what was her name? Honey Ryder.
Yes.
Like, what a name.
They Honey hadn't Ryder. Quite got into to the punny names yet for the Bond women.
Yeah, but her name was Honey Ryder, R-Y-D.
It's humorous, but it's not pussy galore.
No. But, yeah. I mean, it is really like, like this guy. It's Bond is the guy that every guy wants to be and every girl wants to be with.
Yes. And he's kind of the prototype of that.
Yeah.
And one thing I thought was interesting was they had those similar scenes in both films where Bond meets a beautiful woman and he's trying to call in about his mission and he's like, I'll be there in an hour. And then the girl's like, what do you mean, James? And he's like, make it two. And literally, you know, 30 years apart, same gag as in both movies.
Right.
You know, because that's James Bond, you know.
Yeah.
He's concerned about queen and country, but he also would rather, you know, make some time for the ladies. And it's old fashioned in a way. It's a little bit dopey.
Mm-hmm.
But the suaveness of Connery makes it work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like I said, it's old fashioned. It's a little bit misogynistic, but you can't help but grin at it a little bit and be like, that's cool.
Oh yeah, it's super cool. I mean, he was the cat's pajamas. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
Well, he had the perfectly combed hair constantly. Yeah. No matter what was happening, his hair was meticulous.
Yeah,
and he had a great tan. And
yeah,
you know, just he was just burly. And I don't know, but to me, Connery's not the problem with Dr. No.
Uh huh.
Here's where I'm going to start to be a little negative about it. The problem with Dr. No is really the story of Dr. No.
Yeah. And well, I think for both of them, they really have story problems, but go on.
It's just, it's not that interesting.
Mm.
I mean, it's interesting watching Bond outsmart people.
Yeah.
It's like I said, it's fun to watch him be really good at his job.
Right.
What's not fun is the story he's figuring out.
Yeah, it was kind of a really convoluted plot, this Crab Key Island. Nobody knows what's going on there. Nobody knows what's happening. And then he, like, goes to explore it, and then they get, you know,
and it's kind
somehow of, trapped. I mean, they get somehow taken in.
Yeah, and it's basically
and then he gets treated like
A guest.
Like a guest, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, let me take
for you no there, real right? reason, yeah.
No, well, the reason was so that Dr. No could
basically talk, explain my plan.
Right, yeah. Persuade him to be on his side.
Yes.
Join my team.
Yeah.
You've been able to do things that I didn't think that anybody would be able to get past or do. Like,
he just saw the strength, come to my island and not get killed immediately. Yeah. Like, it wasn't that much, really.
Right. And then when he says no, like, you see where he gets put in. Like, he gets put in this huge suite, right? And then when he says no, the moment he says no, like, he gets put in a jail cell. You know what I mean? Like, how he would... Yeah. Probably be treated had he got captured, like, you know.
But the entire secret plot is just, I mean, and it's all cliche now, but the villain just tells him the plot.
Yeah.
What he's doing all at the dinner table. He's like, I want you to admire my plan, Mr. Bond.
Yeah.
Because only you would appreciate it.
Well, I think that was why we always get into this thing, you know, whether no matter what movie that we're in, you know, Lethal Weapon, Die Hard, any of the Die Hard films, any of the, like the big action films where there's a big guy. They tell you what the plot is before the end, but I'm going to trap you in this room so there's no way out, but I'm going to leave because I got this thing to go to.
It's and then
somehow they get out. Yeah, but the reason, at least to me, there was a reason why he explained the story, why he explained that he was doing what he's doing, because he's trying to persuade him to join the team.
Yeah. It's just so much of the movie kind of meanders along.
Yeah.
And then the bad guy's just like, here's what's going on. And then 20 minutes later, it's over.
Yeah, there was a lot of action in the last 20 minutes to kind of wrap it up. I mean, it was a lot of hurry up and wait kind of thing.
And the movie sort of meanders, but it does meander before that. Like, he's just kind of wandering on the island. He occasionally meets someone. Someone may try to kill him.
Or they try to get a picture of him, like the girl who tried to take a picture of him when they're at the club.
Yeah, and he spots her, and he's like, hey, don't do that. Like,
yeah.
And that's kind of the end of it.
Yeah.
And it's just... There's not a lot happens, and I don't mean to, because, you know, movies made at that time, movies made, you know, 50 years ago now, have a different pace, and we accept that, we understand that, we watched movies from the 60s before.
Yeah.
They're structured differently.
Yeah.
But this movie, and I like movies from the 60s, this movie really takes its time and just kind of just shuffles along until the last 15 minutes.
Right. And you really can't figure out, like, what's going on in, like, the last 15 minutes. You're like, I mean, even when he gets into the suit or whatever, you're like, what is he going to do? Yeah. And you still don't know, like, what's really going on.
You don't quite get the bad guy's plan even if he tells you what it is and you see it in action.
Or if we're looking at it through Bond's eyes, like, how is Bond, like, we're kind of pretending like we're Bond. Like, well, if I were him, I would go do this and go do this. Like, we don't even know, like, what, you know. Is he going to be found out?
Yeah.
How is he going to sabotage? How is he going to go after Dr. No?
Yeah.
How is he going to, like, stop the bad thing from happening at the very last minute?
Yeah, basically, he takes out a guard, dresses like the guard, and then just beats everyone up.
Right.
Really quickly.
Yeah. And then he, like, oversaturates the thing. Like, he finally figures out, like, oh, well, if I just turn this, this will, like, overdo everything.
This knob that says danger, like it's the Batman 60s TV show.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he literally goes around and smacks all the bad guys around for a minute, flips a switch to bad, and then the end of the movie ends, basically.
Yeah, like, but, like, if it was really like a nuclear reactor, wouldn't it be like a Chernobyl, like, fallout or
you
something
would think,
like
that? But no one wants, like, mutant Bond running around with, like, three eyes and his hair falling out, you know?
Yeah.
That wouldn't work for the love scene in the boat at the end, you know?
No.
Anyway. But yeah, like literally, he just like judo throws a couple guys and like smacks Dr. No into the water, and that's kind of the end of it. And they make a big deal about Dr. No's got metal hands that are like vice grips, mm-hmm. and he still gets the crap knocked out of him by Bond very easily.
Yeah,
Bond's just like, sit down.
Yeah,
he's just I don't like, care that you're disabled. I'm British.
I'm just gonna kick you into the vat of boiling water. You know.
Yeah. For queen and country.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk about Dr. No for a minute. I know, again, movies made in a certain time period, you have to judge them for what they are, but I couldn't help but cringe when Dr. No showed up as the half-Chinese, half-British person, played clearly by a guy who did not have a lick of Asian heritage in him whatsoever.
Yes.
But he had like eyeliner and his hair slicked back, and I was like, oh, casual racism.
Yeah. I shouldn't laugh at that. It's very sad. It's very, I mean, I'm just glad that it wasn't, maybe he didn't have big teeth. I don't know. I'm trying to see.
No, he didn't, but he literally had like the eyeliner like to make his eyes look a little more slanted, and he had the hair slicked back to, it was a caricature, but it was a subtle caricature, but still enough to make me cringe when he walked on screen. I was like, oh yeah, I forgot that this used to be a thing.
Well, and he was like a, you know, it's supposed to be this mad scientist, madman, but how is somebody like that who is like this, I don't know, he didn't seem to have all these people working for him all the time. We still didn't get like where all his money was coming from.
Well, he said that he ripped off the Chinese triads and all this stuff. Yeah. And it was funny. He's like, I got $5 million from them, and he's got an underground base and like lasers and like tanks.
Yeah. Joseph Wiseman played Dr. No.
Yeah. And he is so not Asian.
Yeah. But yeah, I was just surprised. The thing that got me the most, I think, about it was when Bond, like the secretary for somebody, like he knew that she was kind of either working for the, like Dr. No or this other people, or she was at least paid off by these other people for information because like the file went missing. Like all of a sudden, like the person in charge of the files or whatever, like, oh, it just went missing. Like, and he's like, yeah, files just go missing. And he, you know, catches her kind of spying on them.
Yeah.
So he immediately knows like, okay, something's up, but he still turns on the charm and is like, you know, goes after her. And then, like, when he, you know, drives off the mountain to her place, he's like, oh, somebody's after me. Oh, I'm just going to, like, drive faster. Yeah. And then
I'm going to romance you for all before
no,
I try
no.
to get
and then, the doors. Then the car crashes. And then he's like, yeah, I know what happened. And I know she's the bad girl, but I'm still going to romance her for a little bit before I go turn her in.
That's James Bond. You know, that's what he does. He's I don't know. I guess I'm trying to think of a way to say this. He is, he believes in queen and country, but he also believes in loving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he used that to entrap the other scientists, right? The geologist or whatever, right?
Kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
But again, charming.
But one step ahead of everything.
Yes.
Like, you're just like, oh, this is what he was doing. This is why he did that. This is why he did that. You figured all that out. But the moment he gets on the island, like, all that kind of like falls away and he's kind of like lost. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I didn't really feel like he had a real plan or real thing. Like it just kind of, like you said,
it felt like they wanted to subvert expectations, but they hadn't quite established all the expectations yet.
Yeah.
They wanted to kind of shake it up, but they hadn't fully established who Bond was yet to do that.
Exactly. I have been told by some people that if you want to watch a real true Bond film, from Russia with Love, which was the second movie in this series, more solidified Bond as we know it. And, you know, I went back and watched, you know, Austin Powers. And I went to, there's a website that you can go to that has every Austin Powers, you know, James Bond reference. And more of them reference From Russia with Love. There's a couple of, like, Dr. No references.
Well, there's a scene where they go through, like they're going through the radiation shower, and it's clearly the Austin Powers urination scene after they defreeze him.
Exactly.
It's clearly riffing on the radiation shower,
mm-hmm.
the big plastic suits mm-hmm. that the bad guys wear.
Yeah, the suit that Dr. Evil wears at the end, and also the lair. The entire, like, Dr. Evil's lair is, you know, exactly it like Dr. Nose. Yeah,
Dr. And he wears like, and Dr. Evil wears like the Nehru collar. It's, you know, because it's the vaguely Asian suit.
Right. And apparently, like all of the like Bond villains are like obsessed with sharks for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. But really, Dr. Evil is not based on Dr. No.
He's more Blofeld, right?
Yes, exactly.
See, now, without being a big fan of Bond, I know a good bit about Bond.
Yeah, like you know who Broccoli and yeah. Salzman were, and you knew, yeah.
Eon and all that, yes. Yeah.
So, and you knew like who all the Bonds were and who's played them, and you've watched a couple of the movies.
But like I've seen, out of 26, I think I've seen, at this point, I've seen 10 or maybe even 12.
Right.
I'd have to go back and count them, but probably in that range.
But I mean, when did Austin Powers come out? I mean, that was in the like late
98.
98 or whatever. I mean, and just switching gears and going to The Living Daylights. I mean, this was 1987, this was,
you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. So this was 1987. And, you know, one of the reasons why that they had changed it, I mean, is like the previous film that Moore was in. I mean, he was, you know, super old, which was.
He'd gotten really, you could tell he was old. I mean, like he looked old.
Right.
It was not believable that he was a romantic lead badass character anymore when he looks like your granddad.
Mm-hmm.
Because this, you know, this was before like. 50-year-olds look like Brad Pitt. This was when guys when they were 50 looked like they were 70.
Right, exactly. You know? Well, Roger Moore would have been 59 at the time of
Bit of it and then some.
Right, 1985 was A View to a Kill. Roger Moore, and they'd kind of abandoned the Spectre thing for like a Silicon Valley, you know, kind of thing, which really didn't work and really got like really bad press, which was why they forced to switch it up. And you know, by that time, they'd really almost become sort of a parody of themselves, where Austin Powers seems like very far fetched, but that was done like 10 years after A View to a Kill, which is why like I don't think that you could make Austin Powers if you didn't have movies like The Living Daylights
or Moonraker. Moonraker is a very silly movie.
Yeah,
I mean it's basically a cheesy 60s sci-fi film.
Right.
Just Bond happens to be in.
Right. But I think part of the reason why is there was a little bit of time gap, I think, where Bond had changed. Now, by the time Austin Powers made, and I don't want to like go too long on this one thing about Austin Powers and Bond, but I guess my point is that like the parody, I guess, like you can't make a parody if the parody is already making fun of itself.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Like Bond had to become kind of serious again before a parody made sense.
Yes. That's the point I'm trying to make.
And Living Daylights really took Bond back from being almost farcical, almost like a self-parody, an unintentional self-parody, I think.
Yeah.
I think they didn't realize how far they'd gone into parody.
No, I think it really highlights how far they had gone, you know.
But I don't think it was intentional on the creative parts to be that way. It just kind of happens.
Yeah.
And so they really tried to ground it more with the Living Daylights.
Yeah. I think it's because, you know, you have this one production company and you have these people that are involved with it all the time. It's kind of like you don't really see your kids grow. It's the same sort of thing. Like you don't really see how far you go.
Well,
like,
that brings up an excellent point. I mean, The Living Daylights was directed by a guy named John Glenn. Do you know how many Bond movies John Glenn directed?
How many?
Let me get the list here for you. He directed.
We're looking this up on Wikipedia as we speak.
I'm just making sure. I just want to make sure I get the number right.
One, right.
He did five.
Five, yeah.
Five. He did, let's see here. I'm going to give you the entire list. He did For Your Eyes Only. He did Octopussy.
Yeah.
He did A View to a Kill.
Yeah.
So he did the one right before The Living Day. He did The Living Daylights. And he did License to Kill.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all actually written by the same people, too.
Yeah, I mean it's the same writer, same production staff, same everything, same producer.
It was a factory almost.
Yeah, I mean and the producer has the final say so on some things. So it's like, you know, even if you try to make decisions or want to go a different way, like the producers, no, we're going to, you know, snap it back and we're going to go this way.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes they get it right. Sometimes they do it wrong, because it's like, you know, eventually you try to start, you know, I think you start second guessing yourself. Like, are we staying true to what Bond is, or are we like going in a new direction,
yeah,
or are we staying like with what's current, you know, that sort of thing. And it's like, you know, when your compass like sways,
yeah,
like so many different ways, like, and how do you stay on course?
And I think that's where how the films fail more often, is they try to serve all those different ideas. Like, we gotta honor the past, but we gotta be forward thinking.
Yeah.
We gotta be an action adventure film, but we have to be fun.
Yeah.
And they do all these different things. You can't appease all those masters all at once and be successful every time.
Right.
And these guys, again, did a series of 5 movies, but the same character, same concepts, with the same director, writer, and producing team.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to not have the same. It's not going to be very high quality, because after all, they're just churning it out.
Well, and this is also 1987. You're talking about, you know, a time where, you know, sexual harassment became like a household term.
Yes.
And it was like,
With the Clarence Thomas, Eddie Hill thing.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, and that was, you know, like a worldwide thing, even though it didn't happen in Britain, like this whole idea, you know, like Margaret Thatcher, you know, she was the prime minister, you know, you had a woman prime minister and all these. So it's like, we can't have this Bond just like schmoozing on girls and, you know, with this AIDS epidemic and with this other thing. And, yeah, you know, it was just like they were trying to make and then also you have other, you know, to me, watching The Living Daylights, it seemed more like it was trying to be a Lethal Weapon or a Die Hard, yeah, or a, you know.
Yeah. While still being a Bond movie, but while still being politically aware and,
yeah,
and trying to have him be a bit of a tomcat, but also being more gentlemanly, and it's, mm-hmm, it's, you can tell it's being pulled in so many different directions,
mm-hmm,
and it all, and it really doesn't work because of that. Like, it's trying to appease so many different masters.
Yeah, like he's much more polite. I mean, he almost like asks permission to like kiss the girl or whatever. Yeah. You know, he didn't like force himself, but it just seemed like sort of unnatural. You know, he didn't. Timothy Dalton, as much as I liked him, I mean, it's just like he wasn't like almost like unsure of himself or unsure that this would happen. I mean, it was just like Bond films are just supposed to just sort of happen and be silly and like not be based in reality.
Well, he didn't quite have the confident swagger of Connery.
Right.
Like, he's charming and he looks good. He looks good in the tuxedo.
But Bond gets away with stuff that normal people don't get away, yes, with. That's, I think, the concept that Timothy Dalton maybe didn't get.
Yes. Yeah. He didn't quite carry himself with the same confidence that the best Bonds do.
The crazy Bond confidence. You know, that's like where this guy doesn't really exist, but he can, like I said.
Well, he's basically a superhero.
Yeah.
He's a superhero where his power is being cool.
Right.
And confident.
Right.
And sometimes Timothy Dalton played him too real.
He played him too real. Well, I remember watching this movie as a kid, and I really liked it because he seemed more real. He seemed, yeah, like a more real person who, based on his decisions, based on his instinct, because he knew more than, you know, what other people knew. You, yeah, know, he could see things more than just for face value for what they were.
Sure. And I don't want to come across like I think Timothy Dalton's the weak link here. I think he's the best thing about the movie.
Right.
He's good. I mean, he's fine.
Yeah.
He's a perfectly acceptable Bond.
Right.
Again, where this movie fails is the story is just not that interesting. It has to do with Russian defectors and like arms dealers and the arms dealers played by Joe Don Baker, who's like this big like Texan who does not fit into the world of James Bond whatsoever.
No.
And it's got Afghan like revolutionaries.
Well, let me just go through what the IMDb like kind of summed it up as.
Sure.
Okay, instead of us trying to rehash it.
Yeah.
James Bond 007 is Britain's top agent and is on an exciting mission to solve the mysterious murder of a fellow agent. The task sends him to Jamaica. Oh no, hold on.
That's the
wrong one.
That's the premise for Dr. No.
That's Dr. No. Okay. James Bond 007's mission is to firstly organize the defection of a top Soviet general. When the general is recaptured, Bond heads off to find why an ally of General Koskov was sent to murder him. Bond's mission continues to take him to Afghanistan, where he must confront an arms dealer known as Brad Whitaker. Everything eventually reveals itself to Bond, and that was written by Simon. So basically...
And even that sounds too convoluted.
The fun part of this movie, okay, and I'll point out the point, that was the defection. Like, yes. Where, like, that opening sequence, the 15-minute, like, opening sequence where, you know, things are, like, they have to get this Russian guy, like, he's going to defect. He's this Russian general, and then, like, he's going to defect, and he's going to, like, spill the beans to MI6 and, like, you know, be the guy that tells all
sway the Cold War in Britain's favor.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And so, yeah, they put him on this, like, he's in, he's just over the line, you know. In Russia, and they put him on like the natural gas, like you
pipeline,
know, pipeline.
They got like a special made shuttle that they can shove into the gas line.
Yeah, and they shove him across the border over Austria, and I mean that was like, and then but like he doesn't shoot the girl who was that was supposed to like you know assassinate him. He just like shoots at her gun.
Yeah,
you know, and it was revealed that he you know did it deliberately.
Yes. Because Bond doesn't kill people he doesn't have to.
Yeah, because he's like, no, that girl didn't know what end of a gun that she was holding. Like, he knew by looking at her that she wasn't a professional.
And there are twists and turns to it. It turns out she wasn't actually trying to kill the general. She was his girlfriend. She's trying to cover up his defection or make it look legitimate.
No, he sent her, gave her blanks and said, basically, do this.
Yeah.
And then it's because that he knew that Bond was going to kill her. Because he wanted her dead because she knew too much.
Yeah, and the whole thing is super complicated.
Yeah,
the whole thing and is it's so and it's again, it's just not that interesting.
No,
I mean, there's some good action sequences in it. There's some great like car chase scenes and some practical stunt work.
Here's the other thing too that's also weird is that you have a defection where you have something fake going on, right? Mm-hmm. This shooting and this other thing where you have to figure out. Then he gets captured, right from where he is. At the British consulate or whatever, at that, and then all that turns out to be really fake because they just wanted him back. Like he really wasn't defecting. He really like. So I'm like, well, then what was all that about? Then what was all the defection and all
they
that?
They explain
all
it, but it doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense at all. And then there was this whole idea about arms deal and like. Joe Don Baker shows up as this Texas arms dealer.
He's obsessed with, like, you know, generals throughout history. He basically lives in a war museum for no reason whatsoever.
It seemed like a very sort of a caricature of how British people think of, like, American generals or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's not very interesting. I mean, there's fun parts to it. I mean, some of the romance stuff with Bond and the girls, like, he takes her to a carnival, and it's kind of dopey and sweet.
Yeah.
And Timothy Dalton's great in those scenes, and the girl is lovely.
He's shooting all the things at the carnival to win the stuffed animals, and the guy's going, okay, no more.
Yeah. You're really good at this for some reason, Mr. Random British Guy. Take the giant elephant,
right,
go away.
They go up on the Ferris wheel and, you know, has a little...
At their like high school makeout session, it's cute,
exactly.
And it's but was like much like where Dr. No failed. The overall story is just not interesting.
No,
and you can have these great elements, and both the movies have great elements, but they're just not the what ties it all together. The reason you're watching it for the story is not compelling.
Mm-mm.
You know,
no, and then the other guy was there at the carnival. But he doesn't kill Bond. He kills the other guy.
He's the other thing that I actually really like about Living Daylights.
Yeah,
this is a wonderfully funny 80s villain. Let me please explain
please.
This guy has the best, like, you know, niche assassin gimmick ever. Like, every assassin's kind of movie has some sort of gimmick. Like, maybe he uses, like a gun hidden in a briefcase. Or maybe he uses a knife. Or maybe he's got, like, nunchucks.
And none of these guys really have lines. Well, he had a couple lines, but they were, like, overdubbed.
Yeah. He's this Dolph Lundgren-looking dude. And he's got the best, like, hired killer gimmick ever. He wears a Walkman. It's so wonderfully 80s.
He wears
a Walkman everywhere. And he strangles guys with his Walkman cord. I would have watched an entire movie just about this guy.
I love how the music like goes really loud, but it's like you can tell it's like from the headphones.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Like he doesn't even turn the headphones off while he's strangling them, so they die to the sweet, sweet sounds of ABBA. You know. And I was like, I would watch an entire movie about this guy. Like, you're typical, like, hitman film, but he's just going around strangling guys with his, like, his Walkman cord, you know?
I know. I could have watched him, like, kill off, like, about five more guys.
Like, he could fight another assassin who's got, like, a disc man, you know? Throwing CDs at him, he's blocking it with the case of his Walkman.
And he dressed up like, you know, in like silly outfits. Like he had to dress up like the milkman.
Yeah.
And then the other one, he had to dress up like, you know, the person giving out balloons.
Yeah.
Like, but he always, like, why is he chosen this?
Like, why can't you just be at the carnival? Why do you have to be the balloon vendor and the Walkman guy at the same time? Like, but again, his weapon was a Walkman. I was like, that is the kind of 80s nonsense that I love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the balloons were just set up to do the, basically the gag where you know where he is, basically based on the balloons.
And then you get like dramatic pop, you know.
No. Or Timothy Dalton, like, sees them balloons, and then he hops up over the wall, draws his gun, and it's like a little kid.
Yeah.
You know? I think that's the only reason why they did it.
That old cliche,
exactly. I mean, but I just... completely hilarious. But no, the movie is only like 130 some odd minutes, 131 minutes.
It's 2 hours and 10 minutes. It's long.
And the last part of the movie, seemed very, like Indiana Jones-ish.
Yeah. It's like a whole different film when they end up in the Middle East.
Afghanistan. And
there's freedom fighters on horses and, you know, rocket launchers and like dropping bombs. Like, what is going on? Why is this happening?
Like, it all starts on the movie starts on the Rock of Gibraltar, right? And then they go to Austria, and then there's this whole defection thing happening. And then, you know, then they go back to Austria for the girl. And then it's like, then they have to like escape, and they like, you know, ski down the mountain. You know, in the cello case, which was super cool.
Yeah, she plays the cello, so they end up escaping in her cello case.
That escape scene was awesome.
It's wonderfully silly.
To me, that made the movie. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, that made the movie. But then after that, then you go to, like, the desert, and you're dealing with, like...
Like, to me, the movie almost went too far trying to be politically minded. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, as far as current events of that time period... And it should have had more, like, fun stuff like the cello snow chase.
Yeah.
And, like, the killer with the Walkman.
Yeah.
The kind of stuff they were trying to get away from because they thought it was dopey. Mm. Which is really what makes them fun in retrospect.
Man, when that car, when they get on the ice and they're in that, like, the you know, that fishing, you know, the fishing hunter barn or whatever. Yeah. And then he's like, okay, time to go. And then, like, you know, blops on the door, like, flies open. Yeah. I mean, it's so perfectly done. And then they, like, you know, they shoot missiles at the barn, and then it just like explodes behind them, and they're driving off.
It's excessive, and it's a little bit stupid, but it's fun.
It's so fun.
But again, the plot is not fun. It's dry, and maybe Bond shouldn't be super serious and super of the time period. Maybe it should be more about escapism and fantasy.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, when you just slide in on a cello case, and then there's the, you know,
he's like, wave your passport as we go by.
Waves the passport, throws the cello up to, like, you know, the crossing guard, and then like holds it.
And I don't know, maybe it's because we've gotten older, and I don't need things to be super serious all the time. But I really like the silliness of it way more than anything else.
Yeah, to me, I don't think it had enough, like, sort of comic relief. It didn't have enough of those, like, one-liners. You know what I mean? Yeah. And especially when it got towards the end, it got really sort of void of that altogether.
It felt very generic.
Yeah. And then Joe Don Baker, like we said, as a villain, you know, at the end... And then, like, have a statue, like, fall on him. I mean, I was just like...
Yeah. He's just, like... Yeah. He's from a completely different film, almost. And it's just jarring. And I like Joe Don Baker. He's been in a lot of things I like. He did not fit this film at all.
Well, and then the defector who, like, kind of started it all, he didn't even wind up dead. He wound up, like, you know, just getting jailed or whatever, you know.
Yeah. So it's just not very satisfying and not super interesting, but there are good things about it.
Yeah. And I think that I remembered more the first, like, two-thirds of the movie more than the last half.
It's often how it happens. Your mind kind of glosses over the things you don't like about something,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of forget the bad parts over time.
I think I probably was like younger and then like I got probably uninterested in it after that.
Yeah.
And probably just like whatever. But I will say, I think, you know, this was done before what was it? I mean, this was like, to me, like I said, I think it was like very sort of Indiana Jones. This was done before, what was the movie? What was the Indiana Jones movie they did in 89? It was
The
Last Crusade. And some of those scenes, like the airport scene and the plane that's just going down the plane by itself. And like,
yeah,
you know, it seemed really reminiscent of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it's just similar ideas percolating at the same time. I don't think there's any like theft going on.
No, not at all. It just very sort of reminiscent of that sort of thing. Yeah. But Timothy Dalton plays James Bond. Mariam Dabo plays Kira Milvoy.
Who's the cellist, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you do have M and Q, which Q we didn't really have in Dr. No.
Yeah.
So many listed characters, and like you don't really know what's actually going on.
Yeah.
The MacGuffin of what's keeping it going is just like way too complicated.
And it just doesn't really matter. It has to do with like arms deals and like diamonds.
Well, I think really, Bond, they were getting away from this idea, like I said, of Spectre and of like world domination and like I said, trying to be more real. I mean, and we're talking about this was probably written more in 85 than it was in 87.
Mm, yeah.
And it was more Cold War and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And it's weird. I never thought the sillier aspects would be what I responded to, but they kind of were in both films. I kind of liked when it went a little more fantastical.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I know you don't like Bond films mostly because they're like really dry.
Yeah. As I kind of joked with you, I think the other day when you asked me, I'm like, I said to you, they're just a little too British for me. I like British films. I like British TV shows. It's just there's a dryness to it that I don't quite respond to.
Okay.
And you know, don't get me wrong, I would watch more. I would. I'm halfway through now. Might as well watch the rest of them at some point. But there are ones I'm curious. Like I would watch from Russia with Love.
Yeah.
License to Kill has one of my favorite actors as one of the villains in it, Benicio del Toro,
right,
in one of his first films.
Yeah.
So that's intriguing to me.
Well, and I think, and I know to any of our audience that's listening that loves Bond films and is like cringing at all this kind of stuff, we know that there are better Bond films out there.
Yes.
We know that there are better ones. And if you have suggestions for us, you know, please let us know. We like I said, chose these two movies based upon one, just the genesis of where it got started, and the second one, kind of where things, you know, kind of happened.
Because
in the
mid-80s. Because people didn't really like it that much. Yeah. That was kind of what I wanted to, you know, judge it and see, is it really as bad as people say? And I don't think it's nearly as bad as people make it out to be.
Yeah, I mean, matter of fact, they didn't really bring back, like, Spectre for like even a long time.
I don't think until the Daniel Craig movies. I don't remember.
Well, the last movie that he did, they brought back Spectre. I mean, that movie was called Spectre, right?
Well, no, I think they're actually in the one before that too, but I don't think they were there at all during the Pierce Brosnan years. And again, Bond fans might be cringing as we talk about this,
right?
But
mm-hmm.
yeah, I think that those elements are the ones that I think are the most fun about the series. Again, kind of the more fantastical, you know, cartoonish elements of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. The last movie was in 2015, Spectre. So, I mean, yeah, like I said, I mean, all the other movies were, you know, GoldenEye, Tomorrow Never Die, Casino Royale, nothing to do with like world domination or.
Yeah, not really, no. But yeah, I don't think that we're hating on James Bond. I mean, I don't think they're terrible movies. I just don't personally respond to them that well. Mm-hmm. I get why people like them. There's plenty to like about them.
Yeah, I think, like I said, like the Bond, you know, like I said, is very. He's the guy that everybody wants to be. He's the guy that every girl wants to be with, and I think that it's just, you know, imagine somebody who's as cool as you can be, as tough as you can be, and a, like, what's cooler than a secret agent?
Yeah,
you know, who mingles in with these, with this stuff as like a spy.
He's globetrotting. He's around the world's wealthiest people.
Yeah,
he's around the beautiful women.
Yes.
You know, powerful men.
He's super charming. I mean, he drives like...
And again, he's really good at his job. And there's something very fascinating about watching people in stories who are really good at what they do.
Right. But my point being is, like, I think it's just a catalyst for, like, James Bond is like the catalyst for the action film. You know what I mean? So, like, to me, the action that happens in between is just like the stuff to get to the action parts, like the good part. Like we said, like the explosions and the cool toys that Q is made and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the
like
fun gadgets in the Aston Martin.
Exactly.
Add-ons and stuff like that. There's fun stuff in these movies. I think overall they're too flawed to call them quote unquote good.
I mean, how cool was the Ghetto Blaster?
Oh yeah, that's such an '80s gag too. The missile launcher inside of the boombox.
Yes.
Yeah.
We call it the Ghetto Blaster.
Yeah. You know, that guy's a classically trained actor, and he's just like, at least they're paying me for this.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you gotta love Q, man. You got everybody loves Desmond Llewellyn is Q, and
he's kind of what people think of when they think of Q. Usually, he's kind of he was Q for a while.
I think the last retired like when Pierce Brosnan retired. I think when Daniel Spector came in, they brought in a new Q.
Yeah, they brought in a much younger Q in the Daniel Craig movies.
Yeah,
a guy named Ben Winchlaw.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably butchering his name, but he's the voice of Paddington in the Paddington movies.
Oh wow, okay.
And if you've never seen those, they're delightful.
Okay, all right. Well, let's get into the fun stuff. Let's get into the end. We've talked so much about it, and I have so many notes still, even about the stuff.
Let's hear, man.
If
you go too long, I'll tell you to be quiet.
All right. Dr. No, producers Broccoli and Salzman originally sought Cary Grant for the role.
Really?
Yeah, but abandoned the idea and decided to go with someone who could be like a part of this series. Like they didn't just want a one-off. They wanted to make more movies after that. Yeah. And
Connery wasn't a big star yet, but also Cary Grant does not give off that air of toughness that Connery does. For sure.
Roger Moore was also considered for the role of Bond for Dr. No, but had been too young at the time, or too young looking, because Roger Moore is actually 3 years older than Sean Connery.
Hmm. Well, he had eventually looked like it, so yeah.
Yeah.
Time caught up with him pretty hard.
Broccoli and Salzman liked how, the reason he was chosen is they really liked how he was a big, tough-looking man who moved gracefully like a cat.
Yeah.
All of the furniture was slightly smaller than they would be in the reality, so Bond would look bigger. Ken Adams' sets were so impressed, Stanley Kubrick, that Kubrick hired him for the following year for Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, which is, I think, one of the longest movie titles in history.
And an excellent film. A great satire.
Somebody posted up a picture on Facebook the other day of like this Kubrick collection. They're like, oh, I picked this up like at the thrift store for like $10. It was like six movies. Dr. Strangelove was not one of those movies. I said, where's Dr. Strangelove? You know, but it was like, you know, some of the other ones. You know, but they didn't have that.
Strangelove is good, man. Peter Sellers forever.
Sean Connery was not wearing a hairpiece in this movie or the follow-up from Russia with Love. However, he did wear various toupees in 1964's Goldfinger.
Huh.
And then kind of after that.
Because he started to lose his hair around that time.
Yeah, his hair started thinning out, I think. Julie Christie from Darling and Dr. Zhivago fame was considered for the role of Honey Rider. You know,
I know Dr. Zhivago. Yeah, I've never seen the other film.
Major elements from the novel that are missing from the film include Bond's fight with this giant squid and the escape from Dr. No's complex using the dragon disguised swamp buggy.
Yeah, they didn't really do anything else with the dragon tank, and I always thought that was kind of weird that they introduce it and then they don't do anything else with
it. And you don't really get to see it. It's really dark.
I imagine it must not have looked very good.
Yeah, probably so.
Yeah.
After viewing this movie, the Bond creator Ian Fleming reportedly described, like the writer of the novels reportedly described it as being dreadful, simply dreadful.
He never liked him. Yeah.
No. Sales of Fleming's novel. It's because just know that the novels were used as the basis for the screenplay. And it's just like Hollywood happens, like everything changes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. His books were way more serious.
Yeah. Sales of Fleming's novels rose sharply after the release of Dr. No and the subsequent films. In the 7 months after Dr. No was released, 1.5 million copies of the novel were sold. So he might have not liked it, but he got a lot of book sales.
His bank account did, I'm sure.
Yeah. Sean Connery is morbidly afraid of spiders, and the spider in the bed scene was shot with a sheet of glass between him and the spider. However, some of the parts were reshot with a tarantula over stuntman Bob Simmons.
Hmm.
Crab Key is a fictional island off of Jamaica. However, exterior scenes were in Jamaica, and the iconic Bond gun barrel sequence was filmed by putting a pinhole camera inside an actual 38 caliber gun barrel.
Oh, I did not know that. So like the opening, like when we see through like the gun barrel, you see Bond walk and he shoots at the gun, blood comes down.
Yeah,
that's actually a barrel of a gun. That's neat.
Yeah. Yeah, because you see, like, you move across and all that kind of stuff, yeah. The Rotten Tomatoes, we don't really have any reviews, like, from Roger
that's
Ebert
okay. I mean, that's
or
from
any
the
of that
60s,
kind of
man,
stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the critics loved it back then, okay? Let's just say that, you know, if Roger Ebert, he probably would have given it, like, 3.5 stars.
It was a huge hit at the time, yeah.
Huge, huge hit. Budget was $1 million. Box office, $59.6 million.
Yeah, think about what that would be. That's like saying, if it costs $50 million a day, that's like mind-boggling.
Ah, 59 times 50, you know, basically.
Yeah.
Good God. I mean, that's a smash hit.
Yeah.
People couldn't get enough of Bond after that, basically. Rotten Tomatoes critics, 95%. That tells you how much critics love it. Audience, 82%.
Yeah, I think people go into it expecting like the classic Bond tropes, and there's not a lot of those.
No, there's actually not. Global Games Bond Day was celebrated on October 5th, 2012, celebrating Dr. No's 50th anniversary. That's how old it is, folks. Living Daylights, 1987. It was based on Ian Fleming's short story of the same name. So he also wrote a lot of short stories as well. So, but yeah, to me, Ian Fleming and James Bond, I mean, it's kind of like, Jack Ryan is kind of like our American version of
with Tom,
James Bond.
And Tom Clancy.
Timothy Dalton's debut performance as Bond, as we said. Dalton was considered for a replacement for Connery, but was too young at the time. So that was way back when. And like
they've always had a problem with Bond being young.
Yeah. But they want him young enough, but not too old.
Yeah. But they wanted to be pretty much middle-aged.
Yeah. Like in his 30s. Like in his late 20s, like early 30s.
I think even more like 34. They want like that kind of age range.
Yeah. Roger Moore would have been 59 at the time of filming The Living Daylights.
Yeah.
I mean, so that would have put him in like, I mean, he was 56, I think, when he did A View to a Kill.
And he looked it. I mean, he looked his age.
Yeah. Timothy Dalton only returned as Bond and License to Kill in 1989. So he only made two films, Living Daylight and License to Kill. Christopher Reeve, Sam Neill, and Sean Bean were also considered to play Bond.
I always wonder what I've heard about Sam Neill before. We've talked about Sam Neill on the podcast.
Yeah.
I often wonder what the Sam Neill James Bond would have been like.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Because his vibe is so different than Bond.
Yeah.
I wonder how he would have done.
I don't know if he could pull off like the charming like the way that some of those other guys did. You know
and
what I mean?
Clearly, they didn't think he could either because he didn't get it. But it's just interesting to think about it, you know?
Yeah. Well, Christopher Reeve was offered $1 million by Albert Broccoli to play Bond, and he turned it down.
He probably would have been pretty good.
I don't know how much British audiences would have responded to an American playing Bond.
Yeah, it would have been different for sure.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, he was just, you know, coming off as Superman, you know, sort of fame at that time in 87, and you know, he was considered, you know,
he was Superman.
Yeah, he was Superman, and I don't think, to me, I couldn't really I couldn't really see. Where yeah.
But he's got that dashing quality. That
he
Bond
does have the dashing quality. Okay, so Hal, Pierce Brosnan, and all of this, he actually came in the picture too. Like, he was considered for The Living Daylights before Timothy Dalton was, okay? Yeah. He was the serious consideration for Bond. He was, like, probably the number one choice that they wanted. But problem was that Pierce, like, the NBC series, Remington Steele, NBC canceled, like, Remington Steele, like, 1986. They're like, we're not renewing the series. Yeah. Well, they exercised the 60-day option to renew the series. So, because, like, once they cancel a show, they have 60 days and they can pick it up again.
They can change their mind, basically.
Well, they changed their mind.
Yeah, because Remington Steele was on for a while. Like, yeah. I remember watching it when I was a kid when it was first owned, yeah.
Yeah, and so Broccoli then withdrew the offer because he did not want any association with Remington Steele because he was like, well, I can still shoot and like still do the series and still do this stuff. He was like, Broccoli was like, no, you're not going to be Remington Steele and Bond in like the same year. You're either going to do one or the other. And that's why, you know, he left and we had Dalton and then, you know, Dalton got signed on and then, but like Pierce Brosnan came back, but it wasn't until 1995, like almost 10 years later.
Yeah, much later.
In GoldenEye. Joe Don Baker was hired based on his performance in Edge of Darkness.
Again, Joe Don Baker, I like Joe Don Baker. He's not good in this.
I liked him in Fletch.
I like him in a lot of things.
I wasn't very impressed with his performance in. The opening track is from British rock group A-ha.
Yeah, and John Glenn, who directed the movie, also directed the music video for him.
Oh yeah, that's a cool. I need to check that out on YouTube.
We should. We'll post a link to it when this episode goes live.
Yeah. So if you're unfamiliar with the group A-ha, they did that really popular song "Take on Me."
Take on me.
I wasn't going to sing it, but you can.
Don't be ashamed, right? Come on, sing with me.
No. there's one thing I won't. Now, I don't know. I might do, you know, sing if I get really inspired. The last Bond film to carry a MPAA rating of PG. It was rated PG, folks. All the ones are rated PG up until this one.
Yeah.
This is the last one. I think all the ones after that were like PG-13.
That makes sense. Yeah, none of them have ever been R. So
no, they don't have like nudity or anything.
No, not really.
Budget was $40 million. Box office $191.2 million.
So still really successful.
Oh, I forgot to mention the car in the film is a Aston Martin V8 Vantage. I think the one the year before they like went to Lotus for a year, like that.
And people did not like that.
No.
Bond fans don't like change.
No. So, yeah. So they went with Aston Martin. He's always... there was not an Aston Martin in Dr. No, but I think in From Russia with Love is the first movie he's driving the DB8.
Yeah, well, he doesn't ever drive himself in Dr. No. He's always driven by other people, really, or he takes someone else's car.
Yeah, he drove that like rental, which was like that convertible, but that wasn't a DB8. I think the first one with a DB8 was the From Russia with Love, I think. I don't know.
On that, I don't know.
I don't know. But no, the classic Bond is the Aston Martin DB8. I do know that much. Because I'm a car guy.
You are.
Budget, $40 million. Okay, opening weekend made $11 million, surpassing The Lost Boys that opened the same weekend with $5
million. That's ironic considering we just talked about The Lost Boys.
Yeah, so you know what was going on in 1987? The Living Daylights and The Lost Boys.
We came out the same weekend. We didn't plan that.
No, did not plan that at all. Yeah. Roger Ebert gave it 2 stars.
And on his 4-star system, that's average, I think is fair.
Yeah, that's just basically like it's fine.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment.
Quote, he says, he understood that Bond. He's talking about Timothy Dalton. understood that Bond character was so preposterous that only lightheartedness could save him. The moment that Bond began to act like a real man in a real world, all was lost.
Yeah, he's got a point. It works best when it's a little absurd.
I kind of said the same thing, but he says it so much more eloquently.
He's eloquent, yep.
I know. He's so good. Roger Moore understood that, too, but I'm not sure Dalton does. Joe Don Baker is a kooky, phony general who plays with toy soldiers and never seems truly diabolical. Without a great Bond girl, a great villain, or a hero with a sense of humor, the Living Daylights belong somewhere on the lower rungs of the Bond ladder. But there are some nice stunts.
Fair.
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 I think we agree.
Yeah, pretty much.
Rotten Tomatoes, critics, 72%.
Not bad. Still fresh.
I will say, we looked at a lot of Bond movies and looked at a lot of Rotten Tomato scores. There's really none that are very low. I don't think any of them dip below 70%.
Because they all kind of, well, they're all, again, it's almost a factory.
It's kind of like the Marvel factory?
In a way, because it's producer-driven. The Marvel films are producer-driven as well. I mean, the Broccoli family, or however you pronounce their last name, Broccoli, maybe?
Broccoli.
They are...
I'm sorry for you Bond fans.
It's okay. It's probably Broccoli, but it doesn't matter. But yeah, anytime you have a producer that's overseas that long, it takes on a real uniform quality.
Mm-hmm.
And like the Marvel films, they're very uniform in a way. So as are the Bond films. It's both a good thing and a bad thing in different aspects.
Audience score 66%.
Yeah, I don't get why it's that much lower. I mean, it's not any worse than any of the other Bond films I've seen, really.
No. But in 2012, Roger Moore called The Living Daylights a bloody good movie.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah. I mean, I think all of the Bonds were very, like, considerate towards each other. They never really criticized. They're very British. And I think that even when Pierce Brosnan took it over, when there was talk of, like, American and talk of, like, Christopher Reeve and stuff, there was this huge backlash of choosing, like, a British person. And I know that, like, when Pierce Brosnan left, there was a huge, even bigger push to, you know, for a British actor to play Bond. And I think from going forward, it will always remain a British actor. Mm. Now, Sean Connery was Scottish, and that was sort of considered, but he was so charming that people just, they just went past it.
They don't really think about it. He's the exception more than anything.
Yeah. No Time to Die, starring Daniel Craig. Yeah, I already said this. Released on April 10th.
Yeah, okay. We cut that. We want to cut that part out.
No, that's fine. So yeah, that's. I mean, always whenever we end these, like I try to find something of like what's in the future, what's in store. For
what's
the
funny
next
is
part
because there is going to be a new Bond film, really days before this comes out,
right?
And who knows where it'll go? It's going to be Craig's last Bond,
right?
And then they're talking about the future Bond. A lot of people want Idris Elba to be Bond, to be the first African Bond.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Which, that'd be interesting. I mean, why does Bond have to be a white guy? He doesn't have to be. Why does Bond have to be a man? He doesn't have to be. He really doesn't.
No.
Mm-mm. There's no reason for it.
No.
And I'll be curious to, I hope that the Broccoli family, the Broccoli family, however you say their names, really decide to venture out and do something more daring with Bond in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's the only way the franchise will ever grow and be adaptable for where we're going in the 21st century is by by fiddling with some of those elements that aren't really essential to who Bond is. Bond doesn't have to be an old white guy. He doesn't have to be.
No.
It's not intrinsic to his character.
No.
He just really has to be British.
Right. And charming.
And charming.
Yeah.
And he has to be a lover and a fighter and the most competent person in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really all you need. And those are the things that make Bond intriguing. And anything else, I think you can adjust and play with, tune up, tune down. You know. And I hope that they do more daring things with that in the future of the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be curious to see who becomes the next Bond after Craig, because No Time to Die will be the last Daniel Craig movie for sure.
I mean, I think Bond is more like Indiana Jones than any other character. I mean, the only thing that Indiana Jones is sort of missing is... You know, this is not, he's not going after, like, you know, something in history. Like, this is actually, like, real like spy stuff, and there's no like girl at the end. You
well,
know
he's still
I mean?
He's still globetrotting. There's still love interest. They're still, you know, fighting and loving and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
In a lot of ways, he more so than Jack Ryan, Indiana Jones is kind of the American Bond.
Yeah, but I know. But I mean, even when you watch like Temple of Doom. He didn't like getting stuck in there with a girl, and he didn't want to be around girls and all those kinds of stuff.
Well, no, he did. He was a ladies' man.
I know.
He was.
But I mean,
it's just
he
different.
Didn't have a charming like. It oh, was, I'm going to try to work this just, thing.
It was very much a more of an American to a British kind. He's more of a grew up American.
And I don't want to start a comparison contrast.
Yeah,
of all these
that's another podcast for another day.
Yeah, that's a whole other article. That you
can so read. Let's get down to brass tacks. Okay. Let's start to wrap this up.
Okay.
Have to ask.
Okay,
if you were to rent these movies from the video store, would you keep them an extra day or would you get them back on time?
I'm getting back on time, both of them. I think.
Same here. I'm glad I watched them.
Yep.
I appreciate them.
Yep.
I don't have any desire to watch them again.
No. No, I own the Connery collection. You know, on Laserdisc.
You physical media loving fool, you.
Yeah, I know. Which is Dr. No. From Russia with Love and Goldfinger. And, you know, I plan on watching them. They're enjoyable to a point, but I don't think that, like, I don't know, like, once you see them, it's not like you're, like, wanting, like, to be in that world again over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But sometimes when you get the hankering and you just want to watch a Bond film,
they're there.
You know, they're
yeah.
there. They're there. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's perfectly fine. I mean,
yeah.
You know.
And I have another friend who. Is a cinephile like you, absolutely loves Bond films,
yeah.
has Bond films on multiple media.
Yeah.
I mean, and he's, you know, he has probably more Bond films on all the various types of media that you can think of, on DVD, the special edition, the VHS.
Yeah,
because this one has this director commentary, this has this on it, but this is like this, and this has this on it, but this doesn't have this.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said,
and you wind up, you know, with the same movie across like five different media.
Well, I know many people who are huge Bond fans. I used to write for a very big media outlet, and we had a large European fan base, and they were obsessed with Bond.
Yeah.
Like anytime we ran a Bond news story, it was like traffic for days.
And there's nothing wrong with it.
It's fandom, man.
Bond, yeah.
Like we get excited about, you know, Batman or Indiana Jones mm-hmm. or Star Wars.
Or Marvel, or Super
Marvel,
or Spider-Man.
It's yeah. that's James Bond for them, and that's cool. There's nothing wrong with they're perfectly good movies. They're just not necessarily for me,
okay.
And that's okay. I can't love everything.
And I love. I like The Living Daylights. I really didn't even think. A View to a Kill was that bad. You know, when I watch it,
A View to a Kill is pretty cool. I mean, that's one with Grace Jones, right?
Yeah, Grace Jones.
Yeah, that's pretty. It's,
yeah, I mean, that's
kind
Roger
of
Moore, but
fun.
That's yeah, kind of Roger Moore's last film, last
yeah.
hurrah. I mean, it's kind of, but that was the movie that I guess that they were like Roger Moore's got to go, you know, whatever.
That one's got a great theme song.
Yeah, yeah. I mean Duran Duran's. And the last thing that was one note that I missed. The guy who wrote that did the intro. That was his last, was The Living Daylights was his last film.
Yes.
For some reason, I don't know why. It was the last film for composer John Barry. It was the last Bond film to use a title from an Ian Fleming story until they redid Casino Royale in 2006. And it was the last Bond film to have a rating of PG-13. I don't know why I missed those notes. They were right there in the middle. Sorry.
It's okay, you know. There were a lot.
Now you know, and now everybody knows. And really, every time I see this, I do research and I find a lot of information. And, you know, Bond film is a treasure trove of trivia. And, you know, I mean, I love the trivia. I love the fan base. I love, you know, the stuff that people put into it. I mean, it's like their Star Wars kind of about all the tech and all what he does and all the characters that were in like whatever, you know, it's absolutely great. I mean, it's, I think one of the reasons why, you know, the film franchise and the character Bond has, you know, really continued, you know?
Well, obviously we are geeks and we appreciate fandom and, you know, I appreciate and respect all fandoms, even ones that I'm not a big part of. If something makes you happy, if it motivates you, and gives you something that gives you some enjoyment in life, gives you some escapism, you know, I'm all for it. And, you know, Godspeed.
I will say this, and I'll say this to you too. I watch these movies trying to think of, like, what, you know, why Bond films are so popular. And the biggest thing that I can come up with, when you go see a Bond film, you know exactly what you're getting into.
It's a little bit formulaic, but it's quality escapism. Like, again, it's, you can identify with the character. You kind of want to be him, or you want to be around him. And it's,
yeah, the same way that you know what's going to, like, when you're going to a Marvel movie.
Yeah, you know Captain America is not going to die, you know?
Like, you know Indiana Jones. Like, you go to Indiana Jones movie, you know what's, you know.
Yeah, he's gonna win. He's gonna get the girl. He's going to get the treasure. It's going to be okay. And that's the joy of any kind of serialized filmmaking. It's, again, it's like movie comfort food.
Yeah.
You know, you go to kind of feel, to have fun, escapism, and happy times. The kind of things that, you know, carry you through the harder times in life. Mm-hmm. And that's about the effect on the culture and the effect that movies have on us spiritually and emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. All right.
So I think we're about wrapped it up today, man. So,
we gotta do
recommendations. We didn't do it last time, so we need to make sure we get it this time. You're right. Yeah.
We didn't do recommendations last time?
We did not. So no extra vampire movies for you guys if you missed our last episode.
No, I thought we did. Mm-mm. I swear we did.
Nope.
All right. So what do you got for
us? I was ready to go home that night, so I didn't say anything.
All right.
Fair enough. So, you know, I thought about recommending like, you know, The Kingsman, which is a nice kind of like riff on the Bond mythos with about a gentleman spy. But that's not what I'm going to go with. Okay. I'm going to go with the Timothy Dalton movie I like a lot, where he plays a big part in it.
Sure.
The British film I told you about, this is directed by a guy named Edgar Wright. It's called Hot Fuzz.
Okay.
It's a riff on like Michael Bay action movies set in a small British town. And one of the main supporting characters in it is Timothy Dalton. He's the local grocer, and he is charming and funny, and plays a surprisingly big part in this film.
Okay,
and he's delightful. Again, that's called Hot Fuzz.
Fuzz.
Mm-hmm.
I'm writing it down. You see me writing it down?
I do see you writing it down.
All right, I'm gonna check this out.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Let's check it out. I don't know what recommendations I have, and other than another Bond film.
Well, what Bond film would you recommend out of the ones you've seen?
GoldenEye is good.
GoldenEye is an excellent Bond film, yeah.
I think it's one of the better ones.
Yeah, one of the better villains?
One of the better villains, one of the better Bonds. I mean, I think
one of the better Bond girls, you know, Xena Onatopp, you know, Famke Jensen, or however you pronounce her weirdly Danish name.
We almost should have done GoldenEye for the show because it really, to me, it almost sparked like the reconnaissance of Bond.
Yeah, it really brought Bond back to the popular consciousness of pop culture. But I wanted to watch movies I hadn't seen, and I've seen GoldenEye.
Yeah.
Sometimes the joy of the show to me is to watch movies I wouldn't have watched otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to see things I haven't seen before.
Yeah.
So I kind of trick you into that sometimes.
Yeah. I'm going to go also with another that's unconventional that I really thought of when I was watching like The Living Daylights, and that's Die Hard with a Vengeance, because I think it really follows the sort of Bond ethos where you have this character kind of leading where things are going, where you have this like ultimate villain who's really kind of has the good guy in their sights, but also like got their eye on this like
bigger plan,
this bigger, huger plot plan twist.
And the main character is still very good at his job. And, you know, the villain is vaguely European and monologues. And exactly. Yeah.
So I mean, you could take, I think, Die Hard with a Vengeance, tweak a couple of things and make it a Bond film.
It could be that kind
so
of
if
film.
So if you like Bond films and you discredit like, you know,
American action flicks, give it a chance. Yeah. It's definitely, it's my favorite Die Hard movie.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best Die Hard movies. I think because of that, because there's enough to kind of keep you going. And the fact is, like, in most of the other most of the other Die Hard movies, you see things from like both sides.
Yeah.
But that movie, you're really following just McClane
and
how he's kind of discovering everything.
Sure. And I think that's a good call out. good choices, man. I like them. I think that about wraps her up for this week. On our next episode, we're going to be talking about kind of an unusual trope in films: kids versus terrorists.
Yeah.
Did you know this was a thing, Ryan?
Well, it's kind of funny. No, but it kind of we're almost tying a theme together here, because we had like Lost Boys and the Burbs, which was. I mean, I know the Lost Boys. Mm-hmm. You had like kind of teens involved with vampires,
yeah.
And then we had Russia here involved in like a plot with the Living Daylights with like the Cold War.
And now we have teens in Russia.
Teens in Russia. Well, I mean, what else was going on in the 80s besides like Cold War and like Russia, right?
It's like playing the Barrel of Monkeys game with movie tropes. You know, they're hooking together and linking together. But yes, we're going to be talking about kids versus terrorists with the John Milius 80s propaganda classic Red Dawn.
Ah.
And the 1991 preschool kids versus terrorists in 1991's Toy Soldiers.
Toy Soldiers. Yeah, Red Dawn.
Wolverines! I just like shouting Wolverines.
Yeah, excellent, excellent choices. So, for next week, I am Ryan Acree.
Well, not
next week.
Not next week. 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks!
2 weeks.
Oh, well, thanks for listening, guys. I'm Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Esrie. Go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
License to kill, not get killed.
Welcome to Jamaica, Mr. Bond.
News of my arrival leaked.
Who are you working for?
We didn't advertise it.
What else do we know about this Chinese gentleman?
Nothing except his name, Dr. No.
I'm a member of Spectre.
World domination. Same old dream.
Why is he still alive?
Our attempts failed.
We're not going to fail again.
I thought you'd turn up sooner or later.
Very clever, Mr. Bond.
It's a Smith & Wesson, and you've had your six.
What are you doing here? Looking for shells?
No, I'm just looking. I thought there might even be a place for you with Spectre.
And I'm flattered. I prefer the revenge department.
Fail, Mr. Bond.